If I buy ETH from someone today and the price of ETH is higher tomorrow, that's value that has been transferred from the person I bought ETH from to me. I would say that the demand in crypto in general is to do nothing and be made rich, and people don't really care how that happens. I'm not going to pay anyone to use our protocol. If I have to pay people to use it, it means it's not a very good protocol. I would rather create a protocol that people want to pay to use.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors. MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV, an intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%.
GM, everyone. My name's Tagashi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I'm with Mark Richardson from Bangor. How's it going?
I'm very well, Tagashi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for jumping on. Man, just for the people that aren't familiar with you, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, my name is Mark Richardson. I've been with the Bangor DAO since 2020 when it launched its DAO program in the beginning. This was during the pandemic where I was home without work for an extended period of time. I was trying to figure out how to be useful. So I spent a lot of time researching different, you know, DeFi primitives. And I was really interested in particular decentralized exchange mechanisms more than, say, like lending protocols and that kind of thing, just because it felt to me to be probably, you know, like the most like fundamental of economic or you know, financial mechanisms that you could actually use to power something meaningful. And so I was very attracted to protocols like Uniswap, like SushiSwap, Bangor, Kyber. And it was the Bangor founders and conversations with them and the community members that they were attracting that I think sort of delineated that project for me more than some of the other exchange protocols that were being introduced around that time. And so I became very active as a DAO member. I wrote some of the original like DAO policy. And towards the end of 2020, one of the Bangor founders reached out and asked, like, you know, why do you have so much time to do this? We're not paying you anything. And I said, I'm just happy to do it because I don't have anything better to do. But when the pandemic ends, I will have to go back to work. And so they reached out almost immediately with an offer for full-time employment. And so I became the head of research in January of 2021. And then later that year, I became the product architect. And then in October of 2022, I was asked to take over leadership of the project and I'm effectively acting as the CEO right now.
Interesting. How did you get into this kind of like space? So you were doing like the research in COVID, right? But you actually had a different background. Would you mind elaborating on that? How you got into all of this?
So yeah, I mean, cryptocurrency and blockchain stuff has always been in my periphery. I don't know what it is about the blockchain industry, but it's punctuated my research career in a really interesting way. So for example, I first found out about Bitcoin in 2010 when I was procrastinating writing my honors thesis. And a friend of mine and I were on my laptop at Macquarie trying to figure out how to buy Bitcoin. And, you know, this is the Australian, you know, banking system. So they kept rejecting all of our transactions. It's one of my biggest missed opportunities back then, because, you know, I could have been one of those people that got to buy Bitcoin in 2010. But yeah, couldn't do it. Commonwealth Bank kept saying no, so we basically gave up on it. I obviously finished my honors. I accepted a PhD position at the University of Melbourne. And then after graduating, I moved to California to do my postdoc. And this was in 2015. And I remember around that time was when Ethereum was launching. And so at the beginning of my postdoc, there was kind of all of this buzz around cryptocurrency again. Then I remember, you know, telling people the anecdote about trying to buy Bitcoin during my honors. And then, you know, after I was in California for 4 years working with Professor Gregory Weiss on single molecule field effect transistors and other things. And then when I came back to Australia, I was working at the CSIRO for a year before the pandemic hit. And then basically as the pandemic was hitting and everyone was staying home is when DeFi, just I don't know what it is, but it's like whenever I'm making like a really big change, whether it's, you know, writing my honors thesis and applying for PhD positions or, you know, moving to the United States and trying to start my independent research career, or when the Australian government is sending me home because there's a pandemic, the first thing that happens is something significant in cryptocurrency. And so it's always been there kind of nagging me to do something. During the pandemic, with a lot of free time, I just decided to get involved. So I think, you know, it's always been in my periphery. I just needed the time and energy to actually spend some time looking at it. And I think I would have sooner if my academic career wasn't consuming my full attention.
Since you got this leadership role in Bancor, what exactly is Bancor, and why is it like different to other AMMs? I remember this is one of those unique AMMs, but just for the people that don't really know what it is.
Yeah, it's not even a unique AMM. It is like we invented AMMs. So all AMMs derive from our original implementation.
Even Uniswap.
Yeah, yeah. Uniswap, Kaiba, SushiSwap. We can go over the history of AMMs briefly. Bancor, it had an ICO in 2017. And at the time, it was really big news because it raised something like $150 million, which was like one of the biggest, if not the biggest ICO for that time period. So since then, there have been much bigger. I mean, it just depends on what you call an ICO these days. Because, you know, in my mind, like Chainlink is still like has got the longest running ICO because it still has these enormous like team allocations. You know, just like last week, Sergey moved like $300 million worth of Link to exchange accounts. So $150 million is pretty small in the scheme of things now, but back then it was a big deal. The reason I think it raised so much was because it was introducing a way to perform exchange on a blockchain that didn't require a human intermediary, right? An actual qualified market maker to quote prices, but a smart contract that could do it. We needed to invent a couple of key primitives there. So we invented and still own the intellectual property for AMMs, bonding curves, and pool tokens. And so these were some of the establishing infrastructure for what has become known as DeFi. But back then, DeFi didn't have a name. And Bancor was still seen in the eyes of the Swiss regulator, which is where we're founded. It's just a regular exchange. And so liquidity provision back in 2017 was something that you would need to register to do. So anyone could trade on the liquidity pool, but to actually provide liquidity to it, you'd need to request access and we would like fax you the forms. And there was a big process and that kind of thing. But yeah, it was a fully realized model. So it did N dimensions. So it used hypersurfaces, not just bonding curves. So Uniswap, what they took was what was at the time the most common type of liquidity pool on Bancor, which was the two token 50-50 reserve ratio version. But there were other versions, including pools with three tokens, four tokens. I don't think there was a hard limit, but I don't think anyone did more than like five or six tokens at a time. And so Balancer is a direct copy of Bancor V1, and Uniswap is a subset of Bancor V1. So yeah, like it was the very beginning of decentralized exchange. The real alternatives to Bancor, so the DEXs that are not infringing on Bancor's intellectual property, would be DEXs like Dodo, which has a very unique implementation. I actually think Dodo is one of the most underrated decentralized exchanges in the space. Curve Finance also for Dodo. So Dodo and Bancor were both, I would say, equal first to the plate in terms of concentrated liquidity. So Bancor V2, I think, was the first concentrated liquidity protocol by about a week. And Dodo was very, very close behind. But we had extremely different models. So Bancor V2 was basically exactly the same as Uniswap V3, but was released about a year earlier. And Dodo actually looks a lot more like Curve and was released about 6 to 8 months prior to Curve. Curve, though, has the advantage of like having N dimensions, although it only works really well for stablecoins. Whereas Dodo let you quote prices, right? You would actually get to choose the exchange rate that you want to sort of concentrate and then have kind of these little, I'm not sure if you're familiar with how these bonding curves look, but you know, to have sort of a linear part and then an exponential part. And yeah, the way that Dodo defines that bonding curve is just a beautiful piece of mathematics. It's a shame that they don't get more recognition. So there's the Bancor model, there's the Dodo model, there's the Curve Finance model. And there's not too much more than that. Everything else is a derivative of these primitives.
Right. That makes sense. And how long were you working on Bancor for? I know they now have a V3 that apparently dynamically adjusts the pool's weights and trading fees to optimize for like capital efficiency.
Are you it for Bancor?
Yeah.
So this is what happened. So when I joined the project, the product at the time was Bancor V2.1. So after releasing Bancor V2, which is the concentrated liquidity model, it became very apparent that it just loses money. And we would try and, I mean, it's the same. We also wrote the research report on Uniswap V3, which also just loses money. In general, AMMs just lose money. You could argue that it's just a type of like seller's remorse, or that liquidity providers don't understand the financial primitive that they're buying, or, you know, there's 101 good reasons to argue for it and even more bad reasons. It kind of comes back to our original ethos, which is that the AMM was really designed for liquidity provision by projects, not by community members. The idea being that if you're launching a token, it's your responsibility to make it liquid. And the way that the industry has moved is that no, you know, we will launch the token and then incentivize others to make it liquid. You might have strong feelings about that or not. It doesn't really matter. The point is that we were thinking, okay, if community members are going to be the ones who are making markets, then a good protocol design should be one where they feel comfortable, you know, doing that, where they aren't taking on an enormous financial risk, but maybe a small one. And so we're trying to design a protocol that had sort of a socialized risk component. And we used the BNT token as kind of an underwriting token and had sort of a fee sharing system where they used the elasticity of the BNT supply to mitigate risk and move profits around. The difficulty was that, remember, this is sort of DeFi summer days, and liquidity mining was all the rage after Compound and Synthetics sort of standardized the model. And, you know, I told you already that we just launched the DAO in October of 2020. And the first thing that the DAO really wanted to get done was liquidity mining. Like, literally the first thing. I remember the first vote to actually launch the DAO. And then within a day, people were trying to organize liquidity mining rewards and stuff. And we took the DAO governance like very seriously, and it was very much crowdsourcing ideas and that sort of thing. But the underwriting mechanism, it requires careful attention, you know, because there is systemic risk when you're offering any kind of insurance, which is effectively what the protocol was doing, was trying to insure liquidity deposits against devaluation or impermanent loss. But when the DAO was using the only mechanism that we had to underwrite as a liquidity incentive, it devalued the token, you know, pretty quickly. And that meant that the underwriting mechanism became weakened. And by the time I had finished designing the next iteration of the protocol, which had a much more conservative view of the risks that should be taken, it was already too late. The DAO had spent something like 200 million tokens incentivizing liquidity and that kind of thing. And so the whole system collapsed in a bank run that was precipitated by, yeah, it was horrible. And that was precipitated by the withdrawal of something like two-thirds of the liquidity by wallets that we didn't know at the time, maybe until it was too late, were connected to Celsius and Three Arrows Capital, our two biggest liquidity providers. And so when they went bankrupt and had to withdraw all the liquidity, it basically broke the underwriting mechanism. I'd spent about a year designing the next iteration of that protocol, but after the bank run, decided that we needed to build something else entirely. So I gave up after I took over leadership of the project. This is after the bank run. But what I said I wanted to do was to create something that didn't have any systemic risk in it at all, and that I didn't really like the AMM design. I think that it has a pup, and if projects were still using it with their own tokens, then I would like it a lot more. But in terms of what traders and people are actually trying to achieve, right? People with a financial goal or a view on the market want to achieve, they don't really have a lot of options. And so I spent some time designing what, you know, our new protocol, which is called Carbon. Carbon is an anagram of Bancor. And that is an on-chain limit order book with a couple of other bells and whistles in it. Essentially, this is the new direction of the project. So I've, you know, unlike the Bancor founders, who were a little bit more from the tech world, where acquiring users at all costs is something worth committing to, you know, sort of the Uber or Spotify mindset, I'm a little bit more business oriented, I think. And, you know, maybe they would take issue with me saying that, because they are all very successful entrepreneurs in their own right. But I think when it comes to management of this particular business, I'm much more interested in our bottom line. And so with this new invention, so we've patented it as well. I'm from pharmaceuticals. I'm not really gun shy about enforcing intellectual property and selling licenses. And so the business model now is to sell as many licenses as possible. And that's going really well. We've expanded out of Ethereum now with our first deployment on Base via a licensee, and looks like we'll be on Mantle pretty soon, and Phantom and Arbitrum all over the place. I think we've sold about 40 licenses now, and many more coming as the bull run seems to have started already.
Yeah, definitely. Common is very interesting. It looks like one of the go-to spots if you want to be trading. And you've got a lot of interesting things on it, like all these different strategies you can do, from, you know, limit orders to range, reoccurring. And one interesting thing I've never seen is overlapping. What is overlapping?
Yeah, well, overlapping is actually, it's sort of a recognition of what concentrated liquidity actually is. So I think people get the wrong idea about concentrated liquidity and AMMs in general. So often you'll hear people say that, you know, the trick to making money with an AMM is to make sure that the fees is higher than like the LVR or something like that. And the unfortunate truth is that there's actually no such thing as a fee on an AMM, and there never was. The fee is just like a marketing term that was invented to try and help people understand in terms that they're familiar with why you might do something. So, you know, people come from centralized exchanges where you know that every time you transact with something, there's a literal fee that's paid to the exchange. And so I think that the thinking may have been that, oh, let's call this thing a fee, and then people will want to be liquidity providers because they're being told that people are paying you like a commission to interact with your liquidity, which actually isn't true. What actually happens is that you're just quoting different prices in either direction and hoping that you can, you know, acquire inventory at one price and then sell it again at a different price. And so typically how this is done is that you create a bid-ask spread by augmenting a single bonding curve into two, like creating sort of a split image of it by applying a fee symmetrically in both directions. But what this really does is create two different bonding curves. And so what I did with Carbon was to say, fine, like let's just stop being honest with people, tell them that there is no such thing as a fee. I don't think that they need to hear that. And instead, if they want to create an AMM-like position or to create a concentrated liquidity-like position, let's call it overlapping liquidity, meaning that, you know, you literally set up the price bounds that you are trying to transact in and choose your bid-ask spread manually. So the key advantage here compared to other concentrated liquidity protocols is that if you're joining, for example, Uniswap E3 with like USDC and ETH, you'll generally have maybe three different fee tiers to choose from, like the 0.05% spread, the 0.03%, and it goes down. And then once you've chosen one of those, you have to choose the tick ranges that you want to provide liquidity within. And this is because of the way that infrastructure has been implemented. With Carbon, there are no tick ranges. And rather than choosing from like three different fee tiers, you can choose any fee tier you want. The protocol doesn't have any predetermined settings. Everything is up to the user. But technically, if you wanted to, it would be trivial to demonstrate that mathematically there is no difference between an overlapping liquidity range with a certain bid-ask spread and, you know, an identical implementation using something like Uniswap's infrastructure with, you know, the same tick ranges and a fee that recreates that exact bid-ask spread.
Interesting. Is this basically what asymmetric liquidity is?
No. So symmetric liquidity in an AMM and DeFi context means that you are buying and selling at every price point in a range, meaning that, you know, if you're creating a market with ETH and USDC and the price of ETH goes up, you're going to lose some of that ETH and you're going to get USDC in return. And when the price of ETH goes down, the opposite thing happens, right? There's like a mirror image. And sure, there's a bid-ask spread that causes the position to grow by a small amount. But to a very close approximation, it behaves symmetrically no matter which direction the market is headed in. Asymmetric liquidity is basically the rejection of the idea that you sort of owe the market a refund if the market turns around. So for example, with an asymmetric system, if the price of ETH is going up and you're offering to sell that ETH for USDC, sure, your ETH balance will drop because you're selling it. But if the market turns around and comes back the other way, you get to keep the USDC that you have bought from the market. You are under no obligation to return it back. The bonding curves on carbon are called asymmetric because they only trade in one direction, right? There is no ETH bonding curve. There is just an ETH bonding curve and a USDC bonding curve, and they're different. And you can determine whether or not those curves should be the same size or the same relative concentration. The parameterization of the bids and the asks can be entirely different, whereas in a typical AMM, the bids and the asks have necessarily the same acceleration. So yeah, symmetry means that if you made a good sale, you're going to have to, you know, give it back if the market changes its mind. Whereas in an asymmetric system, if you made a good sale, you get to keep the proceeds of it even if the market turns back around.
I saw recently you guys announced an automatic auctioneer for, I guess, liquidation, right? How did you guys come about this?
So this is, the backstory to this is kind of interesting. So coming back to our bank run scenario, the DAO had a bunch of like some pools in deficit as a result of that. And my number one goal is to completely resolve the deficit forever and then sunset that protocol. I never want to talk about it again. And so we needed a way to try and return value to these pools in a way that is, you know, decentralized, because, you know, we're still regulated in Switzerland under FINMA. And so everything that we do has to be very light touch, has to be done in such a way that we aren't approaching something that might be described as like a broker dealer. We are a DAO, and we need to make sure that everything we do is decentralized. And so it took about a year, but the DAO did sort of self-organize and close down some of the pools that were already in surplus and accumulated these tokens that essentially belong to the protocol and said, okay, we want to use this money to try and alleviate the deficits that remain. And so we sort of started working on this token buyback and burn mechanism to try and, you know, reverse the effects of liquidity mining. But how do you do it, right? Token buybacks and burns are really hard when you're trying to do it in a decentralized way, because you can't have like some signer or something, you know, send funds to Oneinch or to Binance or something. You need to find a way that, you know, anyone can call that function. And, you know, you probably know as well as I do that you can't be reliant on like an Oracle, decentralized or not, right? Whether it's Chainlink or Pith or just the Uniswap V2, you know, price Oracle, all of these things are very easily attacked and exploited. And if you've got millions of dollars worth of value, you better believe that someone's going to figure out how to grief it. I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and I decided that the best thing to do is to create essentially a Dutch auction, or depending on who you ask, a reverse Dutch auction with an exponential price decay curve, where you just basically offer those tokens up to the market. Now, the difficulty is that just because it's doing that doesn't necessarily mean that you're guaranteed that anyone's going to interact with it. And anyone who's worked in lending protocols will tell you that, you know, just because a liquidation is there and there's a liquidation incentive for someone to mitigate that risk for the protocol doesn't mean that anyone's actually going to notice it. And at the time that Carbon was being launched, we knew as well that launching a brand new DEX with, you know, with novel math is going to take a little while for Oneinch and Paraswap and OpenOcean and everyone to integrate with. And so if we wanted to offer users security and execution from day one, then we were going to have to build our own arbitrage network. And so Carbon was co-launched with something called the Arb Fastlane, which now has something like 64 unique callers on Ethereum. But that has all of the infrastructure required to perform flash loans and close arbitrage opportunities wherever they happen to be. But it can also do things like perform liquidations, and we can make it aware of things like a reverse Dutch auction. And so, you know, after a few weeks of thinking really hard about how we were going to do this token buyback and burn, I kind of came up with this design where it's like, okay, let's consolidate all of these, you know, all of these different tokens that we have into ETH first using this Dutch option. And then when we've got all of the ETH in one spot, we can start with a super high asking price and then just slowly let it decay down until it kind of touches down on whatever the market rate is for BNT. And then when that BNT is traded into the protocol, it just destroys it. Now, again, this system is going to be tricky because if you've got an enormous amount of value in a Dutch auction, it can still be like DDoS'd until the price is low enough that someone exploits it. So we said, okay, instead of doing it all at once, we'll use what is kind of been referred to internally for years as the leaky bucket, which I hate that name. But what it means is just do a little bit at a time. And it actually comes from, I'm not sure if you know this as well, but Bangor also invented the cross-chain bridge. And we did have the patent to that one. We had the first bridge from Ethereum to EOS, and we designed the architecture for that. But we actually gave that patent to Liquid Apps when they sort of bought it off from Bancor and became their own project. But whatever. The reason I'm bringing it up is because we knew how insecure bridge infrastructure was going to be. And, you know, we were the first to the plate. And so we said, okay, when you're bridging stuff on and off, you should limit the amount of tokens that someone can move in some time frame. So like maybe the bridge has, you know, a $100,000 cap for the day. And so if people are bridging on or off, once you get to that $100,000 cap, that's it. No more capital can move. And this mitigates so many of the attack vectors that exist for these kinds of operations. And so we've done that kind of stuff before. And so with the automatic auctioneer, I was like, okay, if we've got, let's say, you know, $20 million worth of ETH, let's say that, you know, it will auction off, you know, $200,000 at a time. And so when the ETH balance drops below a certain amount, it will then know what the last transaction price was, like, because it literally just performed an exchange. And so when the ETH threshold drops below a certain amount, it multiplies whatever that exchange rate was by like 10 or 20 or 100 or whatever, and then begins the decay process again while topping up the ETH reservoir. And so what this means is you actually get an effective TWAP, right? A completely decentralized automatic TWAP system without anyone interacting with it, with no MSIG or anything else other than, you know, the funds having to be transferred there in the first place, I suppose. But yeah, completely autonomously will auction off tokens regularly. And so that was sort of our solution to taking this value that the protocol already had and then using that to sort of reverse some of the damage that liquidity mining had done for BNT. And since then, things have done pretty well. So I think we started off with 111 pools in deficit. And since then, I think we've brought 69 of them back into surplus and closed them. So it's making good headway.
Yeah, liquidity mining is really detrimental, I think, the further you go into it. At the start, it's really great, obviously, to get users in, but then you're like kind of locked in this thing, and it just keeps on going, and you're just diluting everything until it just crashes.
Yeah, the reality is that trading is zero sum, right? For someone to make money, someone else somewhere has to lose it, right? It's a poker game. You don't show up at a card table and expect that everyone is going to leave richer. That's just finance. If I buy ETH from someone today and the price of ETH is higher tomorrow, that's value that has been transferred from the person I bought ETH from to me, right? Like it's about disagreeing on the price of things and trying to race each other. It might be an ugly way to look at things, but it's unfortunately it's just true. With incentives programs and things, what you're really trying to do is to bring new capital into a protocol, right? To grow the ecosystem. And certainly liquidity mining was very good at that. I don't think that we would be as successful as an industry as we are today if Compound and Synthetics hadn't figured that out. It should have always been a coupon drop. Eventually, your restaurant needs to start actually selling meals. You can't just keep giving away the food for free. And I don't think that the industry's really, you know, ever learned that as a whole. Certainly, you know, I speak to a lot of people that are equally critical of incentives programs. And the fact that we still don't really know whether or not like DeFi or cryptocurrency has legs. You know, and that's coming from someone who leads a, you know, a cryptocurrency project. But we just don't know because no one really seems to be here to use it for its own sake, right? You could say that, yeah, look at all these protocols and how useful they are. But, you know, at the end of the day, you got to ask people why they're using these things. And they'll always tell you, oh, it's because I was incentivized to do it. These things aren't really self-incentivized, you know, whereas if you ask someone why they bought a video game or why they bought a car or why they bought a computer, they'll tell you, oh, it's because I enjoy doing this thing or I need it to do this. Not because, you know, Apple was paying me to buy an iPhone or to have an iPhone, right? And so there isn't a lot of legitimate business model in cryptocurrency just across the board. And because of the like over-reliance on incentives programs, we actually don't know how successful it would be without it. And I don't mean that into the sense of, you know, there is totally legitimate to do like a flyer drop or have a promotional period where you offer your product, you know, cheaply or even for free, right? Uber has done this and DoorDash has done this and it works because what you're trying to do is to get people to try the product. And if they like it, you want to turn them into a paying customer. Cryptocurrency and DeFi doesn't really have that. Instead, what happens is people come and they use the free service or the service where someone's literally paying them to use it. And then when you're not paying them anymore, they get upset and leave and wait for the next service to start that pays them. So yeah, in terms of like, you know, intrinsic demand for the services in DeFi, it's really unclear whether or not it's there at all. I would say that the demand in crypto in general is to do nothing and be made rich somehow. You know, and people don't really care how that happens. But yeah, I'm trying to do the opposite. I don't want anyone, I'm not going to pay anyone to use our protocol. If I have to pay people to use it, it means it's not a very good protocol. I would rather create a protocol that people want to pay to use.
Yeah, it makes sense. Because actually, I think there hits a cap now of what people actually do that are new and exciting. And I think all the innovation happens of how to actually, like, it's optimized for the most amount of these incentives. Like, for example, everyone during, like, I guess DeFi summer, like, everyone had the pool rewards you would get from joining a liquidity, you know, of a, like, providing liquidity for a new protocol would be insanely high. It would be like 10,000 APY for a single pool or even more. And so, like, people would just optimize.
I remember seeing people, like, reporting, like, 17-figure percentages in APY. And, you know, if you do the math, you realize that, yeah, by the end of the week, you should have more value than there is in, like, our solar system, you know? Like, if you take all of the mineral wealth, all of the gold and, you know, iron and stuff that exists between us and Jupiter, and you somehow harvested it all, that would get you to, like, a 17, you know, figure APY. But people believed it. And you know, and I get it. It's a lie that you want to believe.
But also, it wasn't even like a lie either, because you were legitimately making that money. But
well,
everyone
I mean,
knew it was like only in until a certain amount of time.
It definitely was and is a lie, and it's the reason why you can do it is because people don't know what APY is. So, for example, let's say that you're walking along the ground and you see a $1 coin sitting there, and you go and pick it up for the split second before you touch that coin, and then the split second after you touch it, your APY is like infinite percent, right? Because you're making $1 every nanosecond, all right? Or every, you know, let's say that you're super quick, but you know, how do you measure how long it took you to touch that dollar? Because if it only took you a femtosecond, then you're making $1 a femtosecond. But that doesn't mean that you're making $1 every femtosecond, just that you made it for that blip in time. And so what people would do is they would say, oh, we'll average it. And so I'll give you $100 or, you know, $1,000 or something on this block, but then, you know, we'll just time average it out. And then they would say things like, yeah, but the way that we're going to introduce the time averaging is based on this and this model or whatever. Essentially, they would just cook the books to make the APY seem as large as possible. And then after that, people would just make it up. You know, even today, people are just making it up. They'll say, oh, you know, 110% APY on this protocol right now. But if you actually look into it, it's not even close. It's just a completely made up number because the industry is completely unregulated. There's no watchdog or anyone to even pay attention to this. Even things like protocol fees. You know, I have been in the process of preparing information to be sent to CoinGecko and to, you know, DeFi Llama and other things that, you know, that try to aggregate this information and present it to people. And there's absolutely no quality control process. You can put whatever you want on that form and no one's going to second guess it. So yeah, I assure you, the overwhelming majority of this data is completely fabricated.
It was just all a marketing scheme. But during, I mean, people would still optimize for this though. Like when one is about to drop, it just switches over to another one. I don't know how many people actually did that automatically. I wish I did it back in the day, but
no, I know people
I know
that did
a lot of people that do it manually.
But I've also met people that claimed to have done this successfully. But then when asked to like, you know, when asked what their address is, you can see that even though they were going, you know, like this mercenary liquidity protocol to protocol, they actually didn't make any money. Like I know a lot of people that thought that they made a huge amount of money during the last bull run because of their DeFi farming and actually ended up worse off than had they not done anything at all.
Oh, even like selling the shitty incentive tokens.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you had to look at how much ETH they started with and what the total value of everything that they got at the end of that process, had they just not done anything, like if they were in a coma that year, they would have had $1 million.
Oh, man. I mean, I've heard so many stories like this as well. It's like trading shit coins. If you just held, it would have been way better.
Yeah, but I was getting 600% APY here and I was getting 10,000% APY here. And then you actually go on chain and have a look at how much value did they actually get. And it's like, no, you were down 20% here. You were down 15% there. In fact, you've been down every single protocol you farmed on. But the website says, I'm like, yeah, like the website's going to tell you whatever it needs to tell you to get you to do whatever it is that it's trying to get you to do.
So with Carbon, would you say it's like a solver network in any way? Can you build your own solver to do this kind of order book stuff?
Yeah, I mean, you could. So it doesn't need a solver network. So we expose everything. So it's not like gated like CowSwap is, for example, where, you know, or like 1inch, you know, like, so 1inch has solvers and CowSwap has solvers, meaning that when you approach their exchange and say, you know, this is what I would like to do, only those people who are a part of that network are able to do anything with it. Carbon doesn't work like that. On Carbon, you just post your prices to the chain. And so anyone can just like arrive at the front end, for example, and just see the price and be like, I'll take that. Thank you. Right. It's like eBay. You just post your prices and the tokens that you're trying to sell. And if someone likes the look of it, they will take it. And this also means that aggregators can find it, which is really good. It's just that, you know, after years of experience in the DEX space, I've learned that that arbitrageurs can't be relied on, right? What you really want is very effective arbitrage in a DEX, because the people that are putting their tokens up expect them to be sold when there's a market appetite for it. And so, no. Is it like a solver network? No. It's much, much more like a conventional DEX in the sense that there are tokens and there are prices. And if you like those prices, you can take them. But we do have this kind of solver-like component via the ARB Fastlane. It's just that it's an appendix to the DEX. It's not a dependency.
So anyone can come in and just like click into it and solve everything if they wanted to.
Yeah. In fact, if you go to Carbon DeFi now, you can actually like just click on trade and it will show you the order book, right? Or its own order book, any token pair.
Yeah. A big thing I've seen now, some hype around, is like solver markets versus MEV. What are your thoughts on this and kind of the future of crypto? Just in general?
They're the same. I mean, I think a lot of people have the wrong idea so for years, I've heard that like arbitrage is the reason why like LPs don't make any money. And I've even met like people that I have, there are people within my network who I have an enormous respect for, who are extremely well educated, who I disagree with on this. And I can demonstrate this. Like, I feel like this is like, it's not like to each their own. It's not a benefit of the doubt, right? There's no ambiguity. I really feel like there is one right perspective and there are demonstrably wrong perspectives. The thought experiment that I think helps is that let's say that you're moving out of the country and maybe you want to sell your car and you look up what the blue book value is and you go, okay, this car, its fair market value is, I don't know, $10,000. Maybe it's a relatively new car or something. And you say, okay, I'm going to sell this car for $10,000. And your friend says, oh, you're selling your car? I'll buy it. What's the price? And you say it's $10,000. He goes, oh, I'm happy with that price. I'll buy it from you. And you say, fine. So you get your $10,000 and he gets the car. And then he immediately turns around and sells it to his friend for $15,000, right? That's an arbitrage trade because he knew that there was another buyer somewhere that would pay more for the car than what you were offering to sell it for. But you guys didn't know about each other. Now, the question is, who lost money in that transaction? You would argue the car seller that you lost money because you think that you could have sold it to, you know, your friend's friend for $15,000. So you've made a $5,000 loss. But your friend's friend argues exactly the same thing. He's upset because he could have bought the car for $10,000, right? And you can't both be right, but you can both be wrong, which is that there was no, like, no one has lost money. There was just someone that, there were two people that made a bad trade. Someone that underpriced the car and someone that overvalued it. That's it. Arbitrage is a lot like that. And I'm seeing a lot of systems that are being designed to try and overcome arbitrage. But arbitrage is like what people are calling things like LVR and this kind of thing. It's an MEV, sure, because it's a part of the extractable value. But that doesn't mean that that value is being extracted from liquidity providers. It's being extracted from like the market. And sure, like the liquidity providers might be wrong in the sense that, you know, they should have charged more. It's easy to imagine situations where liquidity providers actually benefit from arbitrage. For example, let's imagine that someone fat fingers an extremely large transaction on Uniswap V2 and pushes the price of ETH like 10x. That kind of stuff has happened. I've seen it. So the price of ETH is suddenly $25,000. And so the liquidity providers in that pool, I guess, are kind of happy because, you know, they've managed to sell their ETH at a massive premium. The liquidity providers everywhere else in the chain are thinking, man, like, if only that guy had fat fingered some of that transaction, you know, in our pool, then we could have made that money as well. And so, fine. What an arbitrageur will do is back run that fat fingered transaction and redistribute the profits to like every other exchange, right? Because what you're really doing is, or what that guy is going to have to do, the arbitrageur, is he's going to have to put ETH back into that pool, reacquire the USDC from it, and then take that USDC and put it back into somebody else's pool. And this kind of equalizes the prices across all of these different systems. Now, what's interesting is that that fat-fingered transaction, you can abstract that away to the entire market. When ETH is like going up or when Bitcoin is going up, it doesn't matter if one person is fat-fingering a transaction or if a million people are doing it. The point is that the price is trending in one direction. And if you're worried that you're going to be missing out on that value, then you shouldn't be selling your tokens. It's that simple. Don't provide liquidity if you're trying to hodl, right? Or at least know that if you are providing liquidity, you are agreeing to sell it if the market has an appetite to buy it from you, and that it's going to be under a very prescriptive trading algorithm that the AMM represents. And this is, you know, this is, again, this is why I'm against AMMs. It's why I built Carbon. Because I would prefer that people choose the prices that they trade at rather than the protocol choosing it for them.
Definitely. I think LPing is very misunderstood. And I mean, I talked to a few people about this, and yeah, you just don't make money on it. That's, I remember I used to actually provide LP, and then I was like, where the fuck's the money I'm making? I thought there was fees. And you just turn out to lose way more than what you actually gain. So it's not really worth. And like, imagine if there wasn't incentives. I feel like crypto would just crash, really. But man, just as the last question, if you were to redo your career, this is kind of like off topic from crypto, but it's always interesting. But if you were to redo your career again, now you've got all this experience, what kind of direction would you go in? And is there any like muck-ups you've done that you could have easily avoided or would have just helped accelerate the career rather than like the trial and error, go back to go forward?
Yeah, actually, that's a really interesting question. I haven't thought about that in a long time. I think hindsight's always 20/20. I wouldn't necessarily not be a scientist again, like, because I was a pretty good chemist and I enjoyed chemistry a lot. But I think that if I had to do it over, I probably wouldn't have come back to Australia because I was already in California for 4 years. I could see my academic career starting to take off. And I think that it was the beginning of the end when I came back to Australia. So I wouldn't have done that. But in terms of where I am now, in terms of cryptocurrency, and I think that I probably prefer, like, I prefer protocol design to chemistry, like, today. You know, like, if someone was to ask me today, if you could go back to chemistry tomorrow, would you? I would probably, like, I wouldn't. I would be definitely 100% staying in crypto and building better, you know, exchange infrastructure. With that perspective, I think I probably should have studied a little bit more math and probably some computer science while I was at university, because I was in a very targeted, like, high power chemistry degree. So I think the only maths I took in university was statistics for data analysis and hypothesis testing and stuff. And that was it. I didn't take any computer science at all. Everything I took was organic chemistry. And so if I could go back, I think I would definitely have taken some more, like, higher level mathematics, maybe some number theory, and at least introductory computer science stuff. I feel like I've got my legs underneath me now with it, but it was a lot more inefficient and a lot more work than it had to be. And if I had just been a little bit more familiar with the discipline before I started, I think it would have been a much, much smoother transition.
So do a lot more research. I guess I like the start of your career and jumping into different fields. You don't know what you don't know. So
yeah, exactly. And I didn't plan to end up here, you know?
Yeah, I feel like it's always a trial and error period unless you speak to people already in that area. Otherwise, maybe a good recommendation is always just, like, try and research the necessary things to excel in what you want to do.
But you know what? Like, I was thinking about this recently. I've met so many people that when they reflect on, like, what they studied, they say, you know what? I don't know why I studied that. Like, it seemed like a good idea at the time. But that was a really dumb idea. And there are lots of examples of that, including in science. I've never met anyone that said, I wish I didn't study, like, that math unit. Like, I feel like it's one of the things that, for whatever reason, maybe this is because I live in, like, a particular bubble, but it seems like no one ever regrets learning more math, right? People regret doing English literature, or people regret doing, you know, organic chemistry or medicine or, you know, botany or whatever it happens to be. But for some reason, people that, like, if you're learning math, people are like, you know what? Like, I'm glad I did that. It was useful for this, or I feel smarter because of it. I understand the world better. That's just good advice for everyone who's, like, anyone who's going into higher education. Learn math. I don't know anyone who's ever regretted it. Whereas every other discipline, I know people that have regretted those.
Yeah, because I think math is so universal, so it kind of just clicks onto everything. But man, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast. I really appreciated this, and I'm glad you got to share some background about yourself, and hopefully it can inspire some people to pursue the same things and maybe get some stuff out of it that could be useful. But yeah, once again, really appreciate you coming on, man.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. You're doing a great job with the podcast. After you reached out, I was going through your backlog on Spotify. I think that this is one of the more sober podcasts out there. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. So it's all thanks to the guests, though, just like yourself. But man, I'm sure we'll have another convo later in the future. And I'm very keen to see how the career progresses.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep me in mind. I'd be glad to come back.
Sick. Well, until then, everyone, take care.